Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at Facebook.com/Radio Cafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Amber Gray. She's the Director of Restorative Resources and Trauma Resources International. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you work with people in all kinds of places. For example, survivors of trauma in war zones, in natural disaster areas, and so on. What is the nature of the work you do with people?
I think it's best to describe my work on a continuum. I began this work as a clinician. Actually, I began this work a long time ago as a massage therapist at a public health professional. I was in Rwanda in 1994 after the genocide, and I was there as a public health professional doing a health assessment for some startup projects in some of the communities that were affected by the fighting. And I was also a massage therapist trained at Cheers here in Santa Fe. And the director of the UN troops found out that there was a massage therapist around, and I ended up doing some body work with some of the troops there. And out of that experience and also out of interactions I had with children in the field when I was going out to some of the communities that were devastated and that were had been depleted of most of their adults, I witnessed how children, in efforts to greet us or to welcome us or to interact with us, often used drumming on any little tin can they could find or dancing. So it was in that moment that I decided to do work that was to pursue studies that were more clinical.
Wait, how did that explain the link that you just made right there?
Okay. Well, I mean, what actually happened is again, you know, I was a public health person, which is very much about program development and wanting to do something that I would say is more hands-on, more direct. I was already a massage therapist, wanted to do something more. In Rwanda, I quite literally arrived at a village in the northern part of the country. It was near the border with Uganda, and it was an area that we were one of the first teams to arrive there. And in arriving there necessitated that we traverse areas that were heavily mined and had been, you know, partially cleared, so we had to be very careful, and there were a lot of checkpoints. So it was a really tense drive. And when we got there, it was clear that the village had been pretty decimated. There was a handful of adults who were sleeping on the floor of what had been a health clinic, and there were a bunch of kids. And I don't speak Kirundi or French. I speak a little bit of French now. I was with a lovely young woman named Claire, who was my interpreter, and these kids gathered around us. And when she explained what we were doing, they literally went around and got shards of tin cans and things like that and did a welcome sort of drum dance. It was the but I'm a dancer. I'm also a dancer. I think that's, and I was also a drummer at that point. There was something in the engagement that happened. They're reaching out using movement, literally, and drumming, which are things I'm passionate about. I knew about dance movement therapy. I knew about somatic psychology, and it was one of those felt sense, oh, this is what I'm doing. If we can interact or engage with one another in this way, this is the medium that I want to work with. So I went home and I applied to NAROPA, and I went and got a master's in somatic psychology and dance therapy, very much with the intention of working with survivors either in conflict situations and survivors of torture. I was pretty focused when I went through that program. I was already almost 40 years old, so...
So what happens to a child or an adult when they are traumatized that horribly by war and especially by torture?
You know, it's torture. I mean, those of us who work with trauma, there's a point when you're talking about the body in relationship to trauma, which is an emphasis of my work, where the body itself as an organism doesn't really distinguish, you know, what the precipitating event is that's creating the situation and the feelings and the experiences that might later on make us traumatized. War and torture, I would broadly categorize, and this is my categorization, so it's not an official one, but they fall into a category I would call extreme interpersonal trauma, which means unlike a natural disaster or a car accident, human beings create it. Human beings are doing to other human beings. And usually the things that they're doing, I mean, in war, you know, I've worked with so many people who've survived sweeps where people come through villages and burn down houses and rape women and kill children in front of their parents. They're unimaginable acts that people do to one another. So it also creates deep levels of betrayal. There's a whole category, and some people who theorize about trauma talk about betrayal trauma and fear-based trauma and different kinds of traumas. I think betrayal is a big issue in certain war-based traumatic experiences, but definitely in torture, because torture as an act between two human beings, extremely intimate. Really good torturers actually think about how to inflict pain. They're very empathic. And, you know, as human beings, we need relationship. And relationship needs trust, and trust needs safety. And torture undermines all of that.
Right.
So I think as a trauma, torture is complex. And I think it has to do with the layers of betrayal and the things that happen to people in the context of human relationship, which in most people's, not everybody's, because not everybody grows up, unfortunately, with healthy relationship. But for the most part, relationship could be a context for safety and for comfort and for being human. So,
well, I have often thought about, and this is probably a sick thought, the structural similarity between a massage table and a table on which mm-hmm. somebody inflicts torture to another person.
Oh yeah, no, and you know, the horizontal position. And I taught a few courses at Shears, or I taught one, I think it was in April. I teach massage therapists, I teach psychologists, I teach psychiatrists, I teach other dance therapists. Those of us who work with the body, whether it's in the context of body work or as there's a lot of people who work with different somatic therapies, being horizontal requires that we have a sense of trust, both in the surface we're laying on or lying on. You know, to lay down, you have to have some sense of trust in whatever's supporting you. But to have a human being touching you or working with you when you're horizontal, it's extremely, we're vulnerable. We're much more vulnerable than we are in the vertical dimension.
Yeah,
so,
and it implies beds and sleeping and things that are very familiar. And then when that is turned around into pain infliction, it is, as you say, the ultimate betrayal.
Yeah, and one of the things that I say is our own body becomes the betrayer. The thing that's really important to understand about torture, and I've written about this in a chapter that's in a book that's looking for a publisher right now, is our bodies become the betrayer. And I think that's the most challenging thing.
What do you mean by that?
Because as a really good torturer will actually work. If you look at a lot of the studies that were done of the Holocaust and what the Nazis did, they became very attuned to people's pain levels, and they would do things like starve people and then give them great feasts to eat, which is psychologically screwy, but it's also, or they interrupt people's sleep patterns. I mean, any movies you watch where there's a torture, it's the middle of the night, you hear the footsteps at 3 a.m. Why do they do that? They're undermining the body's endogenous rhythmicity, is what I call it, the biological rhythm, sleep, eating, going to the bathroom, you know, rest and exertion cycles. So we actually neurologically become rewired. We feel different inside. We behave differently outside. So the body becomes a betrayer because we no longer can yield into our own natural rhythms. I mean, I've worked with so many people who don't sleep, can't go to the bathroom. I've worked with survivors of torture who are constipated for months at a time.
Oh, Lord.
So just, but you know, when you think about, this may sound like a strange statement, to go to the bathroom, you have to be able to let go.
Right.
People can't do that. So I think a lot of literature focuses on the psychological effects of torture, but I think there's a real neurological foundation to what's going on psychologically.
We're talking to Amber Gray. You have started to talk about some of the ways in which the human body responds afterwards. Once a person is back in a situation of safety, maybe they can't sleep, maybe they can't go to the bathroom. What are some other symptoms?
One of the things that I have heard a lot of that I think is one of the most heartbreaking things is people isolate. People will actually say, I can't trust. I no longer can trust the world. I don't trust God. I don't have any faith. but people isolate. And isolation is not, you know, it's currently not one of the, what we would call diagnostic criteria of post-traumatic stress disorder, which is kind of the classic post-trauma diagnosis. But it's probably one of the most common and heartbreaking and challenging things that survivors of torture and of war situations that may not have involved directly involved torture, that people endure. I've known people who, mothers of seven children, who get to a point where they will no longer take phone calls from their children, you know, halfway across the world. I'm working with people right now. We've received a lot of Iraqi refugees who've been tortured in Albuquerque as part of our refugee resettlement program, and I've worked with people who, you know, they won't come out of their room. They're terrified. They stay in the room. I've worked with people who will try to take a bus to an appointment. One person, this was a bus, this was actually in Denver when somebody was in a wheelchair and it was kind of clicking up the bus on the ramp, and the sound reminded her so much of things she'd experienced while in prison, while being tortured, and then she looked at the sea of people and started to freak out. She basically started to have a flashback, ran back to her house and wouldn't leave for 2 weeks. So it's the isolation, and a lot of that comes from the fact that many torturers will tell people, if you talk about this, we'll come and get you, we'll kill you, we'll kill your family, we'll torture your family, and no one will ever believe you. You know, they say horrible things to people to make them feel like they're smaller than, you know, like they're dirt. So people feel really isolated.
And that exact same thing is what happens to victims of child rape, child abuse, and so on in this country, whom probably all of our listeners, whether they know it or not, know somebody who fits that description.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think there's a lot of features, for lack of a better word, that are shared with survivors of torture, survivors of domestic violence, child abuse, people who were raped. I mean, torture, political torture, which is what I've worked with, has a very specific definition, which I can't remember verbatim, but it's, you know, it's according to the United Nations, and it has to do with the intentional infliction of pain and suffering by somebody in an official capacity. That term, the official capacity, gets kicked around a lot. It's like, well, what do we really mean by that? Are militia, who may not be elected officials, are they, you know, officials? So that's really what we're referring to with torture. But the features, you know, the human interaction and the consequences, I think are very much the same. And I would never tell a survivor of long-term child abuse that the experiences that they had weren't torturous, because they are.
So when you encounter somebody who is a trauma survivor, a torture survivor, and it's your first session with them and you start working with them, what do you do?
You know, one of the first things that I say, and I mean, what I do is going to depend very much on the person. You know, along with dance movement therapy, I've studied EMDR, the eye movement desensitization reprocessing. I've studied somatic experience. I've studied cognitive behavioral. I'm a former yoga teacher, so I have a whole toolkit, if you will.
I'm glad you didn't say arsenal.
No. I've probably said things like that. But, you know, I have a craft box, I sometimes call it, to people. But one of the first things I tell somebody, because usually what we have to do initially is do an assessment, you know, find out why the person's coming. A lot of people, in the context I've worked in, more so now, people know that I'm a quote-unquote mental health person, and they're coming to me for that. I've worked in contexts where I'm part of a larger center, and people just come for help. So depending upon who they think I am and why they're there, you know, that determines what I'll do. But one of the first things I always do is I somehow communicate to people, I'm not counting on your trust. Because one of the things that drives me crazy is when, and I've had interactions like this, people say, oh, you can trust me. I never say that. What I'll actually say to somebody is, I need to ask you some difficult questions now. You know, I'll explain who I am. I'll let them have plenty of time to ask questions. And I'll say, if you want to continue, I'm going to be asking questions, and we may talk about painful memories and difficult things, or things may come up. I don't expect that you'll trust me. You don't even know me. So I'll find out what are the things that we need to do if it gets to be too much. I establish that I have to earn their trust.
Which in itself probably is a step toward earning their trust.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've had many situations even now where people, I'll finish like doing an assessment and people say, well, yeah, I'd like counseling, but I'm not sure I want to go to anybody else because I trust you now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's, you know, and I take as long as it takes. A lot of what I do sort of in more of the somatic or body-based realm, and I think anybody does this who works with trauma is stabilization. And there's a lot of theories out and models out there now for working with complex trauma. And, you know, the first phase of anybody's good treatment is stabilization. So
What does that mean?
That means, you know, when somebody is, quote unquote, traumatized, they're destabilized. Their internal systems aren't functioning like I described before. If you look at trauma emotionally, there's it's fear-based. The body has become, in a sense, almost impregnated with fear, for lack of a better way to say it. It's an attentional disorder. People's attention is fractured or distracted by the things that have happened. So people aren't present. And just talking about something, I could ask a simple question about, you know, somebody's past or something that happened, and somebody will start to shake and tremble. They might have a flashback. One of the ways I describe the internal world of a survivor of torture is it's like a minefield. And I'm not forgetting that people, you know, carry beautiful histories and resources, but it can feel like a minefield. So they're not stable. There's a lot of different techniques that are out there for stabilization, but it's really helping a person to have some sense of mastery over their body, again, first and foremost, their emotions, the way they think and perceive the world. And it tends to be very simple. It's things like, you know, feel the ground under your feet. I have techniques I've developed over the years, or methods where I have people squeeze certain muscles with an inhale and exhale and feel a chair, or do something with their spine, curl and uncurl their spine, things that actually stimulate the vagus nerve, which is the nerve that helps to actually restore balance. I mean, I'm oversimplifying this hugely, but helps to restore balance and helps us appraise safety. And so things like that. And over time, stability is like each moment of stabilization is like a thread that ends up weaving, you know, hopefully a larger experience where somebody says, hey, you know what? I've had 2 days and I haven't felt really afraid, or I haven't had a flashback, or I've been able to sleep one night. So that's what stabilization is.
When any regular person is tense, our muscles get all tense and knotted up. I can't even imagine how knotted up and all over the whole body somebody must be who is surviving torture.
Yeah, muscle, it's interesting because muscle tone is one of the things that I think dance therapy is really, really good at working with. And when you read some of the original dance therapists, some of the theorists, Penny Lewis and Marion Chase, a lot of them talk about muscle tone or muscle tonus. And people can either be extremely hypertonic or rigid or tense, whatever word you want, because of holding on, gripping, that kind of fear.
Right.
People can also be extremely hypotonic. Some people will be completely like soft and mushy and collapsed. That's the other side of fear. That's what, you know, that's more of an immobilization or a collapse that happens when fear is the type of intense fear that comes with more of a life threat kind of experience.
Is it analogous to surrender? In other words, like when an animal rolls over on its back kind of thing?
Yeah, although I'm not a scientist. One of my favorite scientist researchers, who's also a colleague and friend who I work with, Stephen Porges, talks about, again, I'm going to oversimplify, mobilization and immobilization. And, you know, you and I now could perhaps be described as being in a state of social engagement. We're interacting. Hopefully we both feel safe. You know, we could move in and out of one another's space. The initial response to fear when there's danger is mobilization, which is that fight flight, you know, high intensity. We get rigid, we get poised, blood rushes to the peripheral limbs. Immobilization is more of the collapse. I think it might be, and I think there's probably grades of immobilization. Surrender, because I've never surrendered. I don't know. Because a lot of times when people immobilize, they actually aren't present. They dissociate. They're gone. Their consciousness, their sense of presence, of being there, is gone. So it may even be beyond a surrender. I mean, it might be kind of the ultimate surrender. It's just a complete
checking out.
Yeah.
We're talking to Amber Gray, Director of Restorative Resources and Trauma Resources International. I would imagine also that for somebody who's surviving torture, that, I mean, you're a massage therapist, but having their body touched, especially in the horizontal mm-hmm. position, would be very difficult.
Yeah, no, it is. It's very difficult. I mean, touch is the first it's probably one of the first challenges in working with that population. Although, I have to say, years ago when I was in Colorado, I co-created and co-taught a course at the Boulder College of Massage Therapy. And it was an associate's degree course in trauma. And the clinic that we created was working with the survivors of torture from the program that I was clinical director of. It was a torture treatment program. And some of the survivors surprised me. Now, you know, it's hard to know if it's because they already were 6 or 12 months into therapy, if, you know, they hadn't had massage therapy, if that helped them to feel safer. You know, I remember one woman from Kosovo, or Kosova, as they say it in Albanian, who had been through horrible, horrible things. And she was an old, elderly woman dressed in the traditional dress. And she literally walked into the room, and I was trying to explain to her. And she just ripped her clothes off and got up and said, "I'm ready to relax," yeah. You know. So, wow. But there are people who, you know, it's not even just physical touch. It's like it coming into their space. You know, we work with the idea of a kinesphere in dance therapy, which is a really rough way to say that would be personal space. It's kind of like a bubble of space around you that you can literally extend in and out of as a right. dancer on one foot. People's kinespheres shrink is what I've seen, so that people actually can't tolerate anybody getting really close to them, or the opposite. The case study you and I were talking about that's on my website, you know, that was a young person.
This little boy named George, who you write about. We'll give the website for that at the end. I'll put it on my website as well, but go ahead.
He was so violated that he didn't know how to have space, so he literally enmeshed with people. So, but yeah.
Meaning he would, when you went near him, he would
press into my body.
Press into your body.
Yeah, in a way that didn't feel safe to me.
Yeah.
So touch, human contact, which is absolutely essential for our development. And I think it's essential for your humanity. I think cultures who have a healthy dose of touch as part of human interaction tend to be quote unquote healthier. It is challenged, and it can take months to work up to physical contact, to touching the shoulder of somebody, to with people who've been tortured.
Do you feel that somebody who comes from a culture where they've had a lot of touch, where they were held there during their infancy and, you know, slept with their parents and all these kinds of things and were involved in cultural practices of dance and other things that involve touch, do they have a different trajectory of recovery?
I think that's a really good question. I think it's something that would be worthy of research that I don't know if anyone's actually done. My clinical hunch based on the years I've done this is that touch and contact and that kind of holding would be essential to their recovery. And I think there's two possibilities. If somebody is so deeply connected to touch and then they're tortured and there's a lot of physical, you know, gross, horrible physical contact, it may create such deep levels of betrayal that it may be very difficult for them to re-engage in touch and contact. But I could also see that person, that could be a resource, that could be part of their resiliency. And they may be one of those people who, you know, signs up for body work after their first or second session, because I have seen survivors like that, because it's so familiar.
Right.
You know, linking to the familiar is really, really important. The familiar that's safe or that's benevolent, very important in what I prefer to call it the restorative process, because I don't think people always recover everything.
Right.
So, yeah, it could be.
I think that's something that's important to understand and also relevant to our own lives, is that there are certain traumas where you can maybe manage and have social interactions and lead a, you know, halfway decent life, but you don't recover to who you were before.
Yeah. I think with a lot of really significant traumas, again, using that word sort of broadly, I don't think we're ever the person we were before. And that's a principle that I work with a lot and I probably start introducing that idea, I'd say fairly early on when I work with survivors, because the longing or the yearning for what was, for being who I used to be, that can create more betrayal. So I never assure anybody that they're going to go back to being exactly who they were. At the same time, they are still themselves. I mean, they are his or herself. But I think it's important to acknowledge that their life-altering experiences and the restoration or the healing or the recovery is around really reorganizing and somehow making creating some sort of balance or equilibrium with the things that have changed, you know, internally and externally.
Let's go back to something you were talking about at the beginning. You go to Rwanda, you're in a war zone, you're greeted in a village by children who are drumming and moving. Those cultural practices, I would imagine, evolved to have a real therapeutic as well as celebratory or other purpose.
One of the things that I say when I do, you know, public speaking or presentations or keynotes or that kind of thing is that, like a lot of current science, if you look at a lot of the current research on trauma, there's this discovery happening. Well, people can't heal if you don't work with the body, or you have to work with the arts or the nonverbal therapies, and it's kind of like, duh. How long have traditional or indigenous cultures known this? The arts, you know, the body-based therapies like dance therapy or other body-based therapies, you know, hands-on healing, the creative arts therapies, art, music, you know, writing, poetry, things like that. That's been the voice of human suffering and ecstasy and celebration and mourning and welcome longer than there's been medicine or psychology or any of it. So, yeah, in some ways, I think we're just rediscovering principles and practices that have been alive for a long time. And somehow in sort of the Western mind-body split post-Cartesian drama that happened, we forgot. So
then you go to Haiti after the earthquake. You've done many, 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 many hours of work there. Haiti is a place that has highly developed and complex drumming and dancing traditions, which we Americans try as hard as we can to learn and so on. How are those used both by you, by healers coming in, and by the people themselves spontaneously in a post-earthquake situation?
That's another really good question. You know, I should say that I've been working in Haiti for 12 years, so the earthquake was sort of the latest evolution in my work there. And in the many years that I've worked with survivors of torture and political violence and street kids, the work has always involved drumming and dancing. What's interesting is that because the drumming and dancing tradition has its roots in the traditions that came over on the slave ships, you know, there's various, the Nago and the Igbo tribes, you know, there was a point, it was actually in 1791 when the story or the legend is that there was this grand ceremony conducted by a Ngon, which is, you know, facilitator of a ceremony. We translate it as a voodoo priest. But that word voodoo has come to mean so many negative things in Western society and culture. The tradition Vodou in Creole, it's a dance tradition. I mean, one of my favorite Creole sayings, if you will, or they have a lot of little sayings, and you know, this is not meant with any malintent, but is that Christians go to church, you know, and pray so they can think about God. Haitians dance so they can know God. You know, and they say it in a joking and loving way because they're also, most of them are also Christians. There's actually not that much separation. But because of what's happened there, because, you know, there's a lot of missionaries who work there, there's a lot of people who are scared of that tradition. So there's actually a lot of Haitians who will get scared of drumming and dancing.
Right.
Because they don't celebrate the fact that it's part of their culture, regardless of spirituality or religion. They go, oh, no, you know, this is that bad thing that we do. So I've had...
Oh, God,
I've
how had, awful.
No, it is. And in fact, part of the work I've done post-earthquake is I trained a team of 5 entry-level psychologists to be one NGO's staff support team. So basically, because it's not sustainable for me to keep going down there and doing, you know, the hundreds of sessions that I've done in psychological first aid or stabilization. So I trained them, and we were talking about dance and movement, and they actually asked me to train them when they discovered how I used movement. And we were talking about their cultural heritage, and they were like, you know what? You know more than we do. And one of the women cried. She said, we're not raised to celebrate this aspect of our history. So I think there's a lot of reparative work to be done in terms of, you know, reclaiming that history. And that's actually, I'm actually have some very dear friends who are working on nonprofits to, you know, post-earthquake, a lot of people are recognize that when something falls down as big as Port-au-Prince fell down, and when a country is as devastated as it is, as horrible as that is, there are also opportunities to remake. So there's a lot of emphasis on, there's a lot of people thinking about, you know what, this is the time where we really get to start to, you know, praise this rich culture that we have and bring the dancing and the drumming, you know, more out to the open.
And see how well it works.
Yeah. And, well, and it, like I said, it's interesting because the team that I worked with requested training. And then I, one of the things I ended up doing, because so many organizations, I had about 30 requests for, you know, mental health support or counseling or staff support kind of work after the earthquake. So I started a staff support working group where we have meetings anywhere from 10 to 50 people will come up from different organizations. And my nonprofit held a training for them on July 29th, and it was at their request. I said, will you do a day of kind of like a mini retreat, but practical movement, you know, and body-based self-care techniques. And it was a great training. And I actually started by talking about their history and going back to that day in 1791 when there was a ceremony around this big, beautiful tree in the north coast of Haiti, and talking about the drumming, and said, this is, you know, this is your center. And this is actually what we're working with now post-earthquake. How do we come back to center? How does Haiti come back and find its core, its center? So it was, I'm actually going to have been asked to go back and do and start a dance therapy training program. So, which is very exciting.
Well, it is very exciting. We're talking to Amber Gray. And there is a certain irony in an American bringing
it's
dance
crazy.
And rhythm to a Caribbean country.
It's crazy. No, I mean, and it's not lost. I mean, there's times where I just, you know, I can't wrap my head around it. And there's times where it feels wrong. I mean, but I've actually struggled with it. Part of my relationship with Haiti is many, many years ago, I met a 90-year-old mambo, which is the female version of the medicine person. And she actually took me under her wing and schooled me and took me through the whole initiation and teaching process. And she said to me, you're a bridge. You're going to be a bridge because your society, your culture, so many people have a negative opinion and we're turning on ourselves in Haiti. She says, there's been so much negativity. So it is, it's absolutely absurd. It's heartbreaking. There's times where it feels all wrong to me. And then, but there's also, there's certain things that I just think are inexplicable and mysterious. And
it happens a lot. I mean, I once taught salsa dancing to a man from Colombia who had lost that tradition or had never mm-hmm. really learned it in the first place, and he'd never heard of the groups from his own country.
Yeah.
And then once he got into it, he got really good and probably knows way more than I do now, but these things happen in all sorts of ways all the time.
Yeah, and I think that kind of reciprocity might be a good word, that kind of, you know, it's a reminder that there are certain things that, you know, there's things to celebrate about unique and different cultures, but there's aspects of those that are very universal. And you know, I think that's part of that kind of coming together and sharing and engagement is, I think, globally really important.
So there's a nonverbal component to this post-trauma work, whether it be post-torture or war or natural disaster. There's also a verbal element.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do they go? How do they go together?
Well, I think, one way that I like to describe it is the human capacity to think, to analyze, to speak. We're not born with the same capacity we have when we're 7 or 14 or 21 or, you know, 30, on and on. That's something that we develop. The root of all human experience is somatic. It's body-based. So when you think of a wee little baby who basically sounds and wiggles and squirms, you know, the attunement or the engagement with the mother is very nonverbal. I mean, there may be some sounding, but there's, it's a very physical, nonverbal attuning to one another's rhythms. That's the base. So we, you know, whether you look at, if you believe in evolution, the development of humans as a species, supposedly from things that did not speak and maybe did not have legs and so didn't move differently. But also, each one of us as a person, we go from, you know, a primarily sensorial, if that's a word, you know, sensation and, you know, sort of internal perceiving, external perceiving being to somebody who can actually walk and talk and think and analyze. So the verbal, sometimes I describe it when I want to be really simple. If our bodies are our roots, the verbal is like the flower, you know, and somewhere in that stem is all the perceptual and emotional that we experienced earlier. And it's like the organization of all of it that becomes the final bloom. You know, and you can layer the transpersonal aspect of being human into that as well. But so I think the verbal is essential. Some people, you know, some of the somatic practices talk about being able to heal without any talking. I think that's possible.
Well, and you've had to do some of that when you don't have a language in common.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, fortunately in Haiti, I speak Creole. So, but back, like when I worked with George, I didn't speak Creole. So that was completely nonverbal.
And George doesn't even, to this day, if what I read is correct, he still does not speak. The torture that he endured was so devastating.
No, he doesn't speak, but he interacts through his eyes and movement and what I would call much more developed movement. I mean, he's a classic example of somebody who had there was no fine-tuning. There was either the collapsed, you know, or the enmeshment,
right,
and, you know, moving around the periphery. And now he can negotiate that space. He can negotiate those more transitory, you know, spaces.
Right.
He may never speak.
Now, in the case of trauma where people can speak, but they're hugely traumatized, how important is telling their story or indeed not telling their story because it might re-traumatize mm-hmm. them?
Very provocative question, because there's a whole discourse about that, and the exposure-based therapists advocate, you know, for telling stories. There's no way you can heal trauma without telling the story. I have been accused as somebody who earlier in my work, I focused a lot, and I still focus a lot about resourcing. I won't even ask anybody to tell their story until we've done resource work till that trust or even a little bit of trust is developed, till they have some sense of connection to what's helped them survive. I've been accused of, you must not have the capacity to, you know, do this kind of work. And it's like, excuse me, even, you know, I just don't push people for stories. I don't happen to believe that everybody needs to tell their story. I as a clinician, I'll listen when somebody's ready and when they want to. But when somebody says to me, please don't make me go back to the past, don't make me remember, don't make me tell, I don't, because the truth is, when somebody's really traumatized, lots of times they remember anyway. The story keeps replaying, whether it's in, you know, a cognitive distortion or belief or, you know, something emotional, people who feel fear every time they see, you know, somebody wearing purple or uniforms, the story will keep playing out. So I believe people can heal without telling the whole story. I think some people can never remember the whole story.
Right. That is probably a very effective and compassionate defense mechanism of our own minds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's, you know, when you get into any of the research on the brain and trauma and memory and all of that, I mean, again, what I say is, why would somebody stay present when they're being brutally gang raped?
Right.
You know, why? I mean, why? It's that dissociation, which has been at some points, I think in time, sort of talked about as a, you know, negative experience. In that time, in that point of time, in that moment, it saves lives. And I recently had Dr. Porges here for a workshop, and he said something that I just thought was brilliant. He says, we have to celebrate these responses in times of danger and threat, because these are what save us, and, you know, recognize that they may not serve us if they keep recapitulating in the future at inappropriate times, but there's a wisdom in that. And so I think it's important to acknowledge that.
We're talking to Amber Gray. So what about healers like you and the many others going into combat zones or post-disaster zones? You suffer your own trauma, I guess they call it secondary trauma and burnout, how do you take care of yourselves?
I dance. I mean, I can answer for me. I think it's actually a really timely question, because about 20 years ago, people started asking that question about humanitarian workers and first responders, firefighters, police, military. And about 10 years ago, it was starting to percolate that maybe people who do this work, even though I didn't live through the sweep or the war, I'm not the one tortured, started noting that people were having the same symptoms as their clients, or, you know, a whole bunch of theories, vicarious trauma, secondary trauma. 10 years ago, a lot of clinicians and a lot of humanitarian workers rejected it. Now, right now, especially after Haiti, and I don't know why Haiti has been so pivotal, you know, it was described as one of the worst, as the worst disaster ever. I think Pakistan rivals that now, but... like I said, I got 30 calls for staff support, which isn't just counseling. It's like, you know what? We need to take care of the people who are doing the work.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of attention on that. And, you know, what they know is, again, social support seems to be the most important thing. So knowing what I tell people, because I do a lot of staff support development work now, you have to know who you trust, who you love, who you care about, who you can email, Skype, call, write, hang out with. Might be people you work with, might not. Having, you know, pictures, kind of stupid, silly things. But I will say to people, if you're going to go out on assignment, make sure you've got pictures of your loved ones. Create a little altar, whatever you want to call it, shrine for them. Human connection and social support is very important. We know that physical activity, it actually releases stress. You know, it actually changes the body chemistry.
Does dance work differently than, like, you know, running or chopping wood or other kinds of physical activity?
I think it probably does and it doesn't. I think it depends on the person. I mean, there's some people who are just going to be freaked out about the idea of dancing, you know, and then there's some people who will, you know, when I'm doing workshops and we'll do some breathing activities where people will start to breathe and I'll have them experience dimensions of breathing. I'll be like, guess what? You just dance. Because dance, you know, it doesn't mean a full on pirouette or something like that. But I think it's the physical release. I mean, dance has the creative aspect, which is really cherished in a lot of cultures.
And the musical, rhythmic thing going on.
But physical exercise, I mean, for a lot of cultures, and I'm not just talking about, you know, different countries. I'm talking about whether you're talking about military or law enforcement or humanitarian workers who can, you know, attract people who, this is, you know, my language can be sort of Rambo-esque, you know. Running, having a punching bag. I did some work in Darfur years ago, and part of my recommendations to the organization was put a gym in here, put a gym in a volleyball court. And they actually put the gym in. You know, you couldn't, the volleyball court had to be covered because it's so bloody hot there, but the people there needed a way to physically release.
Yeah.
And team sports are great for that, especially if there's a little edge of competition, because that actually can help take some of that edge off of, you know, if you're working and living with the same people in a war zone, you kind of want to beat them up sometimes. But so it's better to have something you can, you know, a ball or something you can spike at the person you're annoyed at or whatever. So physical activity is very important. And the usual, you know, the diet and the water and the sleep, which is really hard to do in the immediate aftermath of an emergency. But still, I sometimes teach people, you know what, if you can do 1 second of rest at your desk, take a breath, look at a flower,
right.
You know, just feel a moment of rest.
Right.
Your body had rest.
To what extent do first responder organizations, whether it be disaster relief or whatever, build in this understanding so that their workers can not burn out?
Right now, very little. It's a discussion, and it's one of these widely acknowledged, look, we've got 20 years now of, you know, best practice information, and there's been some research studies done, and it's not universally adapted. But as I said, for some reason, Haiti's been pivotal. I've been contacted by 3 people in the last maybe 2 months who said, we're going to write in a 1% line item on our budget for this grant on staff support. Can you give us the references? Because I've been doing a fair amount of speaking about staff support and secondary trauma since Haiti. You know, what's the reference? I don't remember exactly how many years ago. It might have been in the last 10 years. A lot of NGOs and organizations are writing in a 1% security line item. and a lot of donors are now saying, if you don't have a plan for security, we're not interested in funding you. Staff support is on the cusp. It's right there. CARE, World Vision International, and Oxfam Great Britain have institutionalized staff support. They have, you know, full-time staff support people who they have different systems, but when there's an emergency in any of the places where they work, they deploy. Very impressive. Save the Children had one. They no longer do. You know, a lot of NGOs have gone through budget cuts, but so there's a few organizations. The UN has done some pretty impressive work. So it's coming of age, and my hunch is that in the next 5 years, a lot more organizations are going to be creating systems specifically to offer that kind of, you know, staff support.
What have been some of the greatest rewards for you in doing this work?
I get to meet amazing people. I mean, a lot of people will say, oh, isn't it? It's hard work. People ask if it's hard work, but I've met amazing people. I mean, anybody I've worked with has survived. And I think seeing, you know, in terms of sort of the simpler aspects of the work, when I see somebody laugh for the first time in a few years or the light come back in somebody's eyes, I this may sound strange, but I really enjoy what I do. I have fun. And it isn't to say that there aren't times where, you know, my heart's not broken or I'm not enraged at what I see or I'm not scared. But I really enjoy what I do because I get to see, first of all, I've seen a lot of the world, probably the most horrible and the most beautiful things about the world. And I feel like my life is constantly expanding. And I meet amazing people. And I learn so much.
I can't help but think also that you see what could be done to prevent at least some of this. I mean, prevention of war, which is never focused on, especially in this country, as a way of preventing so many other horrors besides the war itself. What's your take on that?
You know, I think similar to what we just talked about in terms of the self-care or the staff support, I think prevention, you know, that's sort of the essence of public health. And I think that's also really coming of age in terms of medicine and mental health. In the larger arena, you know, in terms of, I'm going to call it global health, war, I think it's interesting because I do think it's possible. I think that's a really huge question, but you know, one thing that I often talk about, and I'm not sure how this relates to what you just asked, but when people, for example, when I've had interactions with people, you know, former employers or something where somebody makes a unilateral decision, this happens all the time in our world. You know, somebody gets handed a decision, somebody gets fired, and they don't know why. Or when I see people be unkind, you know, or just, you know, I'll say to people that is the same energy as war. And a lot of people don't stop to think that if they scream at somebody on the street to get out of the way, or if they, you know, because a lot of times when I'm counseling people, a lot of it will have to do with people losing jobs and in really unkind ways. And it's like when somebody's disempowered, that's the same energy as torture. If you make a decision for somebody and you don't, so I think
it's a difference in degree, but
yeah,
it's the same thing.
It's on a continuum. So I think the prevention, it really does start with us. And I mean, so I think some of those, you know, that bumper sticker that was around for a while, practice random acts of kindness, you know, so those things can get so bubbly. But there's something really important about just remembering, you know, I think if everybody remembered to take a breath and to be kind, and probably if world leaders thought more about communication rather than the sort of defensive posturing in this.
I've often thought they should all just have a big dance on a regular basis.
Yeah, I agree. No, absolutely. I think if everybody danced. I mean, one of the things I've talked about is I think there should be playgrounds for adults all over the world. I think there should be dances. Now, I've thought about that when I see these, you know,
you look at the way their bodies are.
Yeah, yeah.
No, unfortunately, it's time to go. We could talk about this for another 2 hours. But Amber Gray is the Director of Restorative Resources and Trauma Resources International. They're on the web at restorativeresources.net. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.